Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. Author David Ramser will be here with a preview of this evening's presentation for the Juno World Affairs Council. We'll learn about a new coffee shop in Juno called Sacred Grounds, and we'll get the details about this weekend's family day and tour of Treadwell. Taking a look at the weather this afternoon, this evening, and tomorrow, a slight chance of rain between 20% and 30%, switching to mostly cloudy tomorrow night and partly sunny on Thursday. Stay tuned for Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood, in for Antonia Gonzalez. With health care reform on the front burner of U.S. politics, Democrats host a roundtable listening session in Washington, D.C. Earlier today, Senate Affairs Committee Vice Chairman Tom Udall opened the floor to tribal leaders and tribal health advocates to share their views on the potential impacts of the Better Care Reconciliation Act. Lake Superior tribes are restoring lands to their reservations through federal programs. As Daniel Kading with Wisconsin Public Radio reports, the Red Cliff and Bad River bands of Lake Superior Chippewa are buying land to preserve the environment and their homelands.
The Bad River Tribe has restored nearly 3,500 acres of land to its reservation with money from the Federal Land Buyback Program. The program is part of the $3.4 billion Cobell settlement that was reached after the federal government was sued for mismanaging trust funds for American Indian landowners. The program aims to restore lands to tribal ownership that were divided up after Congress passed the General Allotment Act in 1887. The practice ended in 1934. Bad River Tribal Chairman Robert Blanchard says the tribe has used about $3 million to buy ownership of lands that were divided.
We hunt, we fish, and we collect our medicines. We're caretakers of this land, so it is very important to our people to be able to have that.
More than $6.6 million in purchase offers were made. Around 1,000 landowners have accepted those offers through June. At the same time, the Red Cliff Tribe recently bought around 90 acres of land with just under $1 million in Great Lakes restoration funds. Former Red Cliff Tribal Chairman Brian Bainbridge says the land will be added to the nation's first tribal national park.
You know, it's something now that will never be lost, and we can bring our children, our families, get our elders down there, and just live life.
An EPA spokesperson says the land deal is part of a multi-agency effort to protect 10,000 acres of coastal wetlands on Lake Superior's south shore that are vital for native fish and wild rice beds. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
Early last week, the Nanticoke Lenni Lenape Nation celebrated a New Jersey Appellate Division decision connected to the tribe's state recognition status. A three-judge panel gave the tribe the green light to proceed with a civil rights lawsuit against the state. Last Monday's judgment reversed a lower court's decision that dismissed the tribe's right to file a suit. In 2012, the state's attorney general, under the Chris Christie administration, held that New Jersey had no recognized Native American tribes. Subsequently, the tribe pursued a similar case in federal court, alleging unlawful discrimination and violations of the United States Constitution. The federal court ruled in favor of the tribe. Nanticoke Lenni Lenape's councilman-at-large, Reverend John R. Norwood, said he was overwhelmingly grateful the appellate panel saw the reasonableness of the tribe's case. Norwood, who is also the principal justice of the tribe's tribal Supreme Court, further commented on the state's challenge to the validity of his tribe.
The state of New Jersey has been hostile to us for quite some time, and there seemed to be a shift that I have always believed was race-based, that there was the presumption that the only thing American Indians want whenever we try to do anything to improve our tribal situation, uplift our community, that ultimately it winds up in casino development and land grab, and that's an awful stereotype.
He added this legal roadblock has jolted access to health and education funding, stating that this recent victory is not the end to affirming the Nanticoke's tribal status, but instead is simply the end of the beginning as the tribe now awaits its day in court. I'm Tara Gatewood.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
The Community Builders STEAM and Cultural Conference for Native Youth by the New Mexico Indian Affairs Department and Los Alamos National Labs at Santa Fe Community College, July 20th to the 22nd. Support by Sundance Consulting at 505-867-0946. And by Humboldt State University, we know what it means to be rooted in community. You can get your Master's of Social Work and amplify your voice without having to leave it. The part-time online program accepts applications between August 1st and 31st. More at humboldt.edu/socialwork.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, this afternoon's volunteer host, and with me is our producer, Jeff Brown. Thanks, as always, to Jeff. My first guests today are Carl Broderson. He is president of the Juno World Affairs Council, and author David Ramser, who has written Melting the Ice Curtain, The Extraordinary Story of Citizen Diplomacy on the Russia-Alaska Frontier. Welcome. Glad to have you here.
Hello.
Carl, talk a little bit about what's happening with the Juno World Affairs Council. David Ramser is a guest this evening. Tell our audience when and where.
He is. We have a rare summer showing for you to coincide with the publishing of his new book. As always, presentations are at the 360 North Studio in the K2 building downtown. It's at 5 o'clock. There's never a charge. And he's going to be talking about his new book. And I'm very excited.
So it's always free. How many members are part of the World Affairs Council?
We did away with membership. And so let's say we have about 200 to 300 active individuals who receive emails, and anywhere from 10 to 200 show up to events.
We're not sure. And what would you say is the purpose of the World Affairs Council?
To keep Juno informed about important world and historical events.
Great.
So we bring experts to Juno to talk about what they're an expert on, and it keeps us informed.
Thank you. David, you've been traveling the state promoting the book, which was published just recently. And I'm wondering, just to let our audience know, if you can provide just a nutshell of the premise of the book. It's about a very particular time in Alaska history. Describe that.
The book's really about the success of citizen diplomacy between Alaska and the Russian Far East, focused on starting in the mid-1980s. The Cold War basically froze the Bering Strait and prohibited any sort of traffic across the strait for 40 years. And in the mid-1980s, that started to thaw as a result of a number of factors and launched a 30-year era of very productive relations across the strait.
I understand that Alaska Native peoples were at the forefront of that. Why was that?
Well, the Alaska Native people were the ones directly affected by the sealing of the border. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover in 1948, at the height of the Cold War, decided that the interests of the nation outranked the interests of Alaska Natives, who had traveled freely across the strait for thousands of years. And so in May of 1948, he said no more because of the high security situation. So Native families were distanced on either side of the strait. So you had brothers and sisters and cousins from Alaska who had relatives in Russia, and they couldn't see them. And that, as I say, lasted for 40 years. And so Alaska Natives who had contact over there in the 20s and 30s and 40s were starting to get old and fade from the scene, and they wanted one last opportunity to reunite with their Russian relatives.
You were on that first friendship flight in 1988. Describe what that was like for those who participated and where the friendship flight went.
It was the culmination of a series of steps by citizen diplomats, well-meaning folks who tried to melt the ice curtain. And in 1988, Alaska Airlines finally got permission to fly a jet from Nome and landed in Providenia, about 45 minutes across the Bering Strait from Nome. And there were 82 people on the flight, a number of political leaders, including Governor Knowles and Senator Murkowski. I went as Governor Knowles' press secretary. But most of the passengers were Alaska Natives who were hoping to reunite when they landed in Providenia. And in fact, many were able to see people they hadn't seen in 40 years.
What followed after that?
Alaskans, shortly thereafter, couldn't get enough of their Russian compadres across the strait, and there was just so much traffic back and forth. After this area was banned from activity for 40 years, people were just nuts to go back and forth, and so everybody from cold water swimmers to scientists to academics and rock and rollers wanted to travel back and forth. And so actually thousands of people traveled over the next 30 years after the strait was reopened.
And the book, in a very interesting fashion, details some of the human drama associated with that, whether it was Lynn Cox, the long-distance swimmer, making it in frigid, frigid waters. I thought that was very dramatic. To two defectors who approached an Alaska National Guard officer saying, hey, we want to leave Russia, and they were there in an official capacity. There is quite a bit of drama that you portray well in the book. So what happened?
Well, a variety of factors. Alaskans started to get a little tired of Russians showing up at the airport in Alaska, hoping to stay for a couple weeks, not having any money. And I think we got a little weary of that. Vladimir Putin came to power in 2000 and changed the politics in Russia. Under Gorbachev and Yeltsin before him, power was extended to the region, so people living in the Far East were granted the authority to do business deals and cultural exchanges with Alaska. Under Putin, that was all reined back into Moscow, and basically contact with Westerners was strongly discouraged. And it was sort of a hassle doing business in Russia. In 98, there was an overnight devaluation of the ruble, and Alaska, a lot of Western companies who were operating there, including a number of Alaskans, basically lost their shirts and decided it's not worth it anymore.
Was anything sustained? Meaning, what do we have to show for this citizen-to-citizen effort after all those years and the various exchanges that occurred?
There are some important lasting legacies. One is the creation of a visa-free travel program for Alaska and Russian natives. So natives of the region can continue to travel and visit each other without the burden of having to go get a visa from their national governments. It's still pretty expensive to travel back and forth, and there's very little direct air traffic. To get to the Russian Far East these days, you really have to go to Nome and charter across in Bering Air. Whereas before, Alaska Airlines flew to most of the major cities in the Russian Far East.
On a very regular schedule.
Yeah, daily. Yeah. I mean, it's as easy to fly from Anchorage to Magadan as it is from Anchorage to Seattle during the height of all this activity in the 90s.
Do you think that there was any lasting impact on the Russians who experienced the visits of Westerners? I know that many Alaskans went over on exchanges as well as business training, for example.
Yeah, one of the important legacies was the American-Russian Center at UA Anchorage, which was established and funded with almost $30 million in federal funds, mostly earmarks from Senator Stevens. And over a 15-year period, the center touched about 60,000 Russians, 60,000, which is a lot of folks, teaching them Western business practices, how to be entrepreneurs and business people. And also, for example, Rotary Clubs taught the value of community service. And sister city exchanges like Juneau and Vladivostok, I think, broadened the cultural understanding across the strait.
There were some Juneauites who were prominent in this movement, in particular Dixie Belcher. Please explain who she is and what she organized even before the Friendship Flight, I believe.
Mm-hmm. I think Dixie's one of the most important figures in this era. In 1986, she got permission, which was a pretty amazing task, from the Soviet government to take 67 Alaska musicians singing and dancing their way across the Soviet Union to try to promote peace and reunification across the Bering Strait. Her concerts were very effective, standing room only in a lot of cases. But I think the most important contribution was she established a relationship with a key aide to Gorbachev, a guy named Gennady Gerasimov, who was Gorbachev's spokesman. And Gerasimov worked inside the Kremlin for many years to open up relationships across the strait. And I think Dixie is owed a great deal of credit for helping make this era successful.
And although this was the beginning of Glasnost, it was still 5 years before the Berlin Wall fell and the actual structure of the United Soviet Socialist Republic also crumbled. So she was way ahead of the formalized opening of Russia per its letting go of or being forced to let go of its various satellite countries.
Yeah, she was there at a very key time. She brought Gerasimov to Juneau and to Alaska several times. She took him out to Jay Hammond's homestead, where he used his first outdoor privy. This was an ambassador who was used to living high on the hog, and Dixie introduced him to the Alaska way of life.
There are many such vignettes in the book that really capture the kind of the everyday details of this, as you call it, citizen diplomacy. In today's world, where virtually every day there is a blaring headline regarding Russia, its alleged interference in American politics, and what feels like an increasing tension between two superpowers in the world, kind of reminiscent of our own childhood. Mm-hmm. Part of your book reflects on diving under your desk for the, you know, the nuclear drills every week, and I do recall that. What can we take away from this effort of citizen diplomacy that might help us think about or inform the current state of affairs?
Well, certainly the situation has changed dramatically since Gorbachev was in office. We're now dealing with President Putin, who's a very different type of Russian leader. But I do think there are some lessons to be learned from this era. There's a lot of goodwill across the Bering Strait between Alaskans and Russians. I was just over in the Russian Far East last summer, and Russians were just crazy about meeting we Alaskans and wanted to come back this way.
These were primarily indigenous people in the small villages.
Correct, living a subsistence lifestyle. After the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990, these people were back to their subsistence roots, hunting and fishing walrus and whales and collecting berries. Very rustic subsistence lifestyle, very little cash economy. But I do think that one of the areas of greatest cooperation between us and Russia is in the Arctic, as the Arctic changes dramatically. 40% of the world's Arctic is within Russia's borders, so the Arctic is very important to them. And, of course, the only reason the United States is an Arctic nation is because of Alaska. So I think that we can play a key role in trying to achieve some cooperation with Russia in the Arctic.
We're talking with author David Ramser. He has written the book Melting the Ice Curtain, The Extraordinary Story of Citizen Diplomacy on the Russia-Alaska Frontier. He will be the presenter this evening at 5 o'clock for the World Affairs Council. It is a free session at the ground level of KTOO at 360, which is the studio downstairs. You can find his book, Melting the Ice Curtain, during a book signing right now across the way at the State Museum Bookstore. It is also available at Hearthside Outlets as well as at Costco. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I love coffee. I love tea. I love the Jaffa Jive, and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the Java and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup. I love Java, sweet and hot. Whoops, Mr. Moto, I'm a coffee pot. Shoot me the pot and I'll pour me a shot. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup. Oh, slip me a slug from that wonderful mug, and I cut a rug till I'm snug in a jug. A slice of onion and a raw one. Draw one.
Waiter, waiter, percolator.
I love coffee, I love tea. I love the Java Jive, and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the Java and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
Boston beans.
Soybeans.
I said a little itty bitty green beans.
Cabbage and greens.
You know that. shoot me the pot, now pour me a shot. A cup of that sand. Ooh, slip me a slug from that wonderful mug, and I'll cut a rug that's snug in a jug. Drive your nickel in my pot, Joe. Take it slow, waiter, waiter, percolator. I love coffee.
We are getting great pleasure listening to that song. Thank you, Jeff. And it is very apropos because my next guests on Juneau Afternoon are Rayanne Holm. She is the Communications Director for the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indians, Indian Tribes of Alaska, CCTHITA for short, or for long, and the Central Council's President, Richard Peterson. And we're going to be talking about a new coffee shop in Juneau, and I understand there was a contest to name it. Is that, who wants to talk about that? I love the name, but talk about how it got named. Richard?
Well, we had a contest. We had about 170 submissions, I think. We had some really great ones, plays on words like sovereign tea and coffee, things like that, but we had several submittals of sacred grounds, and it really resonated and had that double entendre.
And where will sacred grounds be, and is it open?
It's open. We've done a soft open, but the grand opening is this Friday. I think it's at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m.?
11 a.m. to 2 p.m.
2 p.m., thanks. And it's at the Andrew Hope Building next to Elizabeth Pradovich Hall. And we're going to have a great street access and awning there, and you can do a walk-up window, or you can go inside and enjoy nice seating and Wi-Fi and all those amenities.
So I should ask, I know parking in that area is a little bit tight. Will there be a couple spots for customers to pull in?
That's definitely something that we're working on and addressing now, because it is very tight there.
So why a coffee shop that's, you've had a cafe there in the past, there have been some other small entities, but now this is open to the public and you're advertising it as such. Why the change of focus?
Well, we're trying to take advantage of opportunities and think more holistically. So at our VTRC, our Vocational Training Center, we are starting barista training, and so it made sense to have an outlet so that some of those folks could immediately get some on-the-job experience, work experience through our TANF programs and our work experience programs. But then, you know, we have other plans in the community that are pretty well known. We've got the old Thane site, and we're going to be putting an immersion park there, so we'll want to open up a coffee shop there. And as we develop other properties and do things, it just seems like a great way to build that built-in infrastructure and have an outlet for that training.
Ryan, let's back up for just a second. I do want to come back to the immersion park because I know it's in progress, Richard. Ryan, talk a little bit about the structure of the tribe. I do know that it was created, not the tribe itself, but the Central Council, out of a very long-standing lawsuit by tribes here in Southeast Alaska about their rights, and it was Congress that finally settled that with a settlement that became an endowment for the Central Council in 1967, 30 years after the first suit was filed. Talk about the structure of the tribe. How many members are part of the Central Council? How many communities are represented? And what the Central Council does?
Oh, sure. At the moment, as of our last Tribal Enrollment Committee meeting, we have over 30,000 tribal citizens enrolled. And that's tribal citizens not just in Southeast Alaska, but throughout the world, really. Because of the structure of funding right now for us, you know, we have our compact funding, our Bureau of Indian Affairs funding, but in addition to that, a lot of our funding is federal funded based, which limits us, and that's, you know, really, and President Peterson's probably a better person to speak on this than me, but that limitation from our federal funding is what we're trying to kind of move away from, because we have such a large base of tribal citizens that are outside of our service area that we really want to be able to provide more service to.
What are some of the services that Central Council provides?
It's social service based. There's financial assistance, emergency assistance, training assistance, higher education assistance. That's kind of the larger basis of it.
We have workforce development, tribal assistance, needy family programs, probably one of our biggest, TANF, which we operate federal and state funds for. And what Rayanne's alluding to is one of the problems is we have over 30,000 tribal members worldwide, a little over 6,000 right here in Juneau. But, we're confined by the programs that we deliver to service area. And it's really disheartening to tell your tribal citizens that may live in Anchorage or, Sacramento, Seattle, sorry, we can't help you because you don't live in your service area. And they're like, well, am I not Tlingit? Am I not Haida? And so what I've brought in since I've been elected president is the idea of we're sovereign. Well, we should be economically sovereign. And that means to have self-determination, we have to afford it. So we're doing economic initiatives. We bought a contracting company in the lower 48, does government contracting. We're going to start some other initiatives. The coffee shops is one locally. But it gives us that opportunity to be self-determined and kind of have that direction to help our citizens wherever they are and not be defined by a service area provider.
Richard, your background is in entrepreneurial work, if I recall. You're from Prince of Wales, is that correct? Community of Cathan?
Yes.
And you worked, I know, with the, you have lots of public service experience, both on their city council, with the regional school board as well. Talk about your entrepreneurial efforts. Clearly your eyes light up when we talk about this. Talk about your background in that, and then let's talk about the immersion park and what your vision. And when I say your, I recognize that the Central Council works as a team.
Yep.
It's not just one person.
When I ran, I literally said I don't have the answers, but collectively we do. Economic development's definitely a passion of mine, and people ask me, well, economic development tribes, how's that? And I'm like, well, we invented commerce.
Good point.
We fought wars with each other over trade and barter. That's commerce. So, we're just taking that to, the modern stage. And, every community lives and breathes on jobs. I was the president of the school board. I served on the school board of Prince of Wales for 10 years. And it was so disheartening to watch a school close because of lack of jobs. So I kind of just threw myself into economic development, and my tribe organized Village of Kasan and the Craig Community, Craig Tribal Association formed a partnership, and we created an economic company called Powtech, and we did government contracting 8A, and to this day it's viable and operating and doing very well for itself.
We should clarify 8A is a section of a government law that gives preference to contracting companies that are owned by underserved populations in terms
Correct.
Of their representation in the business world, including those of Indigenous heritage.
Yeah, and I apologize for falling back on the term 8A because I actually don't like that either, because you're not an 8A company. You're a company that has 8A status. And, there's other statuses and opportunities. You can use Bi-Indian Act, Hub Zone. And 8A is just one vehicle to really, get out and market yourself and make yourself attractable to, whoever you're trying to win a contract from, whatever federal agency or what have you.
What is your vision for the former Thane Ore House, which is about 4 miles out Thane Road? It's got a wonderful setting at the water's edge there. It's got a rather large building and a commercial kitchen. What is the vision? And talk about the timing.
Yeah, absolutely. So we worked through the CBJ, Cibero Juneau, and got the bid for the old Thane Ore House. And then there's private property owned by a company named Avista next to it with the big shop. Well, we were able to get all of it. And we have a long time, 35-year lease with the CBJ, and we're working to purchase from Avista. And so we're going to build an immersion park where we can celebrate our culture and our history. You know, I tell people our culture isn't a costume. So we're going to be doing activities out there for ourselves, for our people, for our clients, TANF, and work experience, and they're going to gain experience. We're going to have master carvers come out there, and we'll rotate them, and I hope to bring them in from different communities so that we can benefit our villages. I want to really interact with our villages, and like artwork that we sell at the shop come from directly from the villages. We'll have dance performances, we'll have language classes, we'll have weaving, and we're going to have a lot of classes that are year-round out there, but we'll utilize the tourism to supplement that, you know. So I like to say we're not there for them, they're going to be there for us. And so, you know, of course we want to make it a great experience for the tourists, but it really, first and foremost, it's going to be a place for us to celebrate who we are, to perpetuate who we are, and to make sure that our culture, you know, lives for another 10,000 years and those generations. We want to be a partner. We want to work with other tribes. We want to work with SHI, Gold Belt Heritage. We want to be a catalyst. We don't think we're the answer, but we think we're a piece of the puzzle.
About how many jobs do you think that the immersion park could provide potentially, and what is the timeline you foresee for opening it as operational?
Well, I think the goal is to provide probably between 100 and 120 jobs seasonal, and then, you know, we'll scale back for year-round operation and what we do there. So, you know, that number is still in flux as we're developing our business plan. And but I think we're really looking at 2019, if we're really aggressive, to be built and open. Some would say sooner, some will say later, but I think that's a pretty safe numbers, 2019.
Now, you've mentioned federal funding. Rayanne referenced that in terms of being a determinant, how money can be spent and what services are delivered through the Central Council. Are you seeking investors for the Immersion Park, or where is the capital to create what you need to have out there?
It's really going to be a mixture. We are developing a funding strategy right now. We plan to bring in some potential funders very soon for kind of a tour and experience so that they can see and envision what we want to do, and hopefully they'll want to invest. But we do already have some EDA funds.
What is that?
Economic Development Agency.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry. You tend to speak in acronyms.
And it would make sense if we were having a business meeting, for sure.
Sure. So we have some funds there. Myrna Gardner, who's our business and economic development manager, has done a phenomenal job. She's quite brilliant at what she does. So she's been working diligently to put together kind of the funding strategy, the business plan. You know, it's a work in progress, but it's really going fast.
There is, of course, a heritage center just outside of Anchorage, and there is a First Nations Heritage Center as well in Whitehorse. Are you and your team looking at other examples elsewhere, and are you engaging professional designers, for example?
Well, we are looking at others, other establishments, and there are some in the lower 48 as well that are pretty amazing, visitor centers, tourism, education, all that. And we will be looking for designs and the folks that will help us really put it together. So I think this winter is when a lot of that work will happen.
What if I'm a visitor from down south, or anywhere, mm-hmm. shouldn't just be from down south, mm-hmm. I'm visiting Juneau, and I do think there are a lot of visitors who would like to have the opportunity to see original people's information, artwork, and that sort of thing here. What is it you would want any visitor to most take away from a heritage park such as what you're envisioning?
I would like to see, or for them to see, that our culture is living and evolving. That, you know, when you talk about our art and some of those things, it was incorporated into daily life. It had practical use. It still has practical use, that we utilize everything, that we have respect for, you know, oneself, for each other, and for, you know, our planet, for the resources. I always considered that our people are caretakers for the resources. You know, so we have a fundamental obligation to make sure that resources continue to be plentiful and available. And so I'd like to see that in practice, and so that they have that takeaway. And that, you know, our people, you know, I think Rosita Worrell with SHI has done a masterful job in some of the work that they've done with their camps and things like that. And I think that they've really touched on some of those things. And I'd love to see a partnership develop there where we can share. You know, they do math camps based on culture and language. They're using showing how longhouses were built using math. You know, I think I like to show that our people were amazing. We weren't and we aren't savages or lower, you know, that we were actually quite brilliant and we still are, and that we're taking that in this modern day and propelling forward. You know, I think we had mastered agriculture. We had gardens, we had clam gardens, we had fish traps, we had systems, and we knew about utilization and keeping those resources growing.
Some incredible technology
was
developed.
Absolutely.
So I know that there has been a broadening of the offering of native languages, Haida, as well as Tlingit. I don't know about Tsimshian.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see a resurgence? Are you feeling optimistic about the preservation of language and culture in this region of the world?
Most definitely. You know, is it happening quick enough? Probably not, but it's happening, and it's exciting to see our young kids are getting exposed to it at greater depths and opportunity. You know, the TCLL program here in Juneau. You know, again, SHI does like the Baby Raven Reads, and they're doing so many programs. Gold Belt Heritage is doing a masterful job as well, and you're seeing more opportunity. University of Alaska Southeast has really embraced language, indigenous language. You know, a professor there, Lance Twitchell, has really been working hard to make sure that happens. And there's language warriors developing in every community, and we want to be a catalyst. I want to see all of our languages in Southeast rise together, you know, whether it be Tlingit or Haudkill or Shamalgic. We want to see those have equal opportunity and thrive. You know, I'm Tlingit, but come from a Haida village. And, you know, I've watched our Haida language, Haudkill, just really shrink to almost nothing, but now we're seeing it come back. And it's amazing. I think there's, you know, less than 12 fluent Haida speakers left in the United States, you know, so there's a sense of urgency. And, you know, at Central Council, we've made space available, and they have classes weekly for Haudkill and Shamalgit, and we're getting there with Tlingit. Our need hasn't been as much for Tlingit because the university is doing some. There's a group downtown doing some, but we're trying to fill every hole, you know, every vacancy there. So we're trying to get Tlingit classes going. We have in development immersion daycare for Tlingit. And so the teacher there has been hosting Tlingit class once a week there, but it's off for summer. But we want to get that going again and make sure that there's just always opportunity. And for me, you can go to the university and take a class, and I encourage you to do so, but, you know, you shouldn't be prohibited by the cost to learning your language. So we want to do all we can to make those opportunities available to everybody.
I think the Tlingit Language Group meets, I believe it's every Monday evening for
right.
free. I regularly see those public service announcements.
At Richard, the downtown library,
yes,
I think.
Yes, downtown. Richard, what do you see ahead as the greatest challenges to the Tlingit and Haida people of this region in sustaining them as a people? American Indians and Alaska Natives are the fastest growing demographic in terms of reproduction in the country, and that's very encouraging at both levels. What do you see as major challenges for Indigenous peoples, not only in this region, but in this country, where they are those who really were the pioneers?
Sure. You know, one of the beautiful things about the United States is we're this melting pot. but it's also kind of to our detriment a little bit that, you know, I'm from the village, and seeing the out-migration from our villages is really disheartening, and we get sucked into these urban areas and kind of lost a little bit. So we need to kind of pull together, make sure we have those opportunities. I think having our villages, and as well as our urban communities like Juneau and Anchorage and others, have social and economic opportunities that were healthy and viable. You know, we need to make sure that, you know, I'm always going to go back to economic, you know, and I think that's really a linchpin to why people are leaving the villages, because we're losing opportunities. You know, timber resource has gone down, fishing to some degree has gone down, and so, you know, how do we get with the modern era, how do we take advantage of some of the things that we could bring out to the villages? High-speed internet. Maybe you can do economic development online with your art. You know, there's so many things that we can do that we have to try to work together and hold our villages together, keep our schools open. You know, once you lose a school, you lose a community. There's just no two ways about that.
And you have to have at least 10 children for a school to attract state funding.
Yeah. So. I know when I was the president of our school board, our superintendent had a really great idea, and that was, if you lost kids, if you got 9 kids, you got 90% of your funding. If you got 8 kids, you had 80%, you know, something like that that would give a village that time to rebuild, you know, as a family moves or something happens, you know. So it's keeping this community viable, though. I think that's the big thing, and the answer is there. You know, we have it in ourselves to do it. We just have to come together and do it.
I want to thank you for your time. We're talking with President Richard Peterson. He is president of the Central Council Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. He was joined by Rayanne Holmes. She is the communications director for the Central Council. And we started out talking about the opening of Sacred Grounds, and there will be a special opening this Friday, 11 to 2. It is on Willoughby Avenue in the Andrew Hope Building. And congratulations on the business, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 18th of July, 2017. It's the birthday of Nelson Mandela, born in Mvetso, South Africa, in 1918. First member of his family to go to school, devoted himself to working for an end to apartheid. And to that end, he spent 27 years in prison. He later said of his release from prison, "As I walked out the door toward the gate that would lead to my freedom, I knew if I didn't leave my bitterness and hatred behind, I'd still be in prison." Nelson Mandela, who said, "A good head and good heart are always a formidable combination, but when you add to that a literate tongue or pen, then you have something very special." It's the birthday of Thackeray, William Makepeace Thackeray, born in Calcutta, India, 1811, best known for his novel Vanity Fair, a novel without a hero, a novel about two women, Amelia Sedley and the ambitious Becky Sharp, who says, "I think I could be a good woman if I had $5,000 a year." It's the birthday of the playwright Clifford Odets, Philadelphia, 1906. He became one of the founding members of the Group Theater in New York in 1931, and he wrote Waiting for Lefty, a play about a union strike, which was a great success, as was Odets' next play, Awake and Sing, about a Jewish family in the Bronx during the Depression. It's the birthday of Jessamine West, born Jennings County, Indiana, 1902. Family moved to Orange County, California, when she was young, where she grew up in her father's lemon grove. Her first book was a collection of short stories about Quakers, The Friendly Persuasion. She was a cousin of Richard Milhouse Nixon, and she babysat him when he was growing up. And it was on this day in 64 A.D., the great fire of Rome began, raged for 6 days. According to the historian Tacitus, it began in a dry goods store near the Circus Maximus. Some people blamed the Emperor Nero for the fire, and Nero blamed an obscure religious sect, the Christians, and tortured them to death in the amphitheater. Here's a poem for today by Lorianne Bosseler, The Pleasures of Hating. I hate Mozart, hate him with that healthy pleasure one feels when exasperation has crescendoed, when lungs, heart, throat, and voice explode at once. I hate that. There's bliss in this rapture. My shrink tried to disabuse me, convinced I use Amadeus as a prop. Think further, your father, perhaps. Well, I won't go back. Think of the shrink with a powdered wig, pinched lips, mole. A transference, he'd say, a relapse. So be it. I hate broccoli, chainsaws, patchouli, bra clasps that draw dents in your back, roadblocks, men in black knee socks, sandals and shorts. I love hating that. Loathe stickers on tomatoes, jerky, deconstruction, Nazis, doilies. I delight in detesting and love loving so much after that. The Pleasures of Hating, a poem by Lorianne Bosseler from Small Gods of Grief, published by Boa Editions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to calculate baseline scores and training programs with 50 challenging brain games. Learn more at lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm this afternoon's volunteer host, Lori Scamblain, and my final guests today are Kaya Henriksen. She is the program director at the Juno Douglas City Museum and a very active volunteer who will be leading a walk through Treadwell next Tuesday, Jim Garrity. I guess we shouldn't promote the walk because it's sold out. Is that right, Kaya?
Yes. Yeah, so next week's walk, which is it's Wednesday, the 26th, has sold out, but we do have another walk that will be happening on August 24th from 5:30 to 7, and that one still has space available.
And how much is that?
It is $25.
Okay. Jim, how did you get interested in Treadwell?
Well, I like any kind of stories, and I'm a lifelong hiker, and so I was really interested in that sort of thing anyway, and then I had a good friend, Willette Janes, that helped me look into history in an authoritative way. That I found out that a lot of the real stories behind things were far, far more interesting than the rumors.
Give me an example of a rumor that was simply that and the real story behind it, for example.
Well, one of the ones you hear frequently about Treadwell is that there was a tunnel that ran underneath the channel and came up on the Juno side, and you could cross out underneath the channel. That just never happened for the very simple reason that they built tunnels to retrieve gold, and there's no gold under the channel. So, but the actual, it was below sea level, so it went diagonally down into the earth until, if you drew a line straight up from the bottom of the Treadwell workings, you would be slightly out under the channel, but there was no tunnel that went underneath it.
Paint a picture for us of Treadwell at the turn of the century. I know that in 1882, John Treadwell purchased the claim, which had been made 1 year before, at the Paris Lode, and eventually there were four large operating mines. Paint a picture for us of the town of Treadwell, which at the time became the largest city in Alaska, if I recall.
Yeah, that's right. And Judge Wickersham pointed out that And not only was it the largest employer in the territory of Alaska, it was the majority employer. So most of the people who drew a paycheck anywhere in Alaska were working at the Treadwell.
And there were up to 3,000 on the payroll at any one time.
There was a tremendous amount, number of people there, and very high-paying jobs, too. And they demanded excellence. So,
when you say high-paying, put that in perspective for us.
Well, I know one family that I guided over there a few years ago sent their sons to get a job at the Treadwell from Norway, and they traveled all the way around the world and got the jobs they were after from their extraordinary hard work. And so it was well worth doing, for people.
How much gold came out of Treadwell in the 40 years that it was operational?
Again, I'll quote Wickersham on that. He pointed out that at no time during the Yukon Gold Rush with 100,000 men going up there to make their fortune, did they come anywhere close to producing the amount of gold that was coming out of the Treadwell at the same time.
And we're talking 1882 to 1922, a few years after the cave, so-called cave-in, which was 100 years ago this year. I recently went to see the play Treadwell, and one of the things I was surprised about was how many warning signs there were about the instability of the town.
Yeah.
Talk about that incident and what some of the warning signs were.
Well, they had, underground collapses. Some of the stopes, which is the mining cavities, had collapsed and the surface had subsided. So it was like a dent at the surface.
A sinkhole or something?
Yeah, only not a vertical shaft, just kind of, like I said, like a dent in the surface. And a lot of buildings were leaning, a lot of floors cracked, and it was obvious what was going to happen. And it was made even worse by the fact that as they got deeper and deeper into the earth, they had to make the rooms smaller, and the hanging walls, the support structures bigger in order to support the massive weight of 2,600 feet of rock above them. And so what they found was that it became less and less profitable. And the depth had very little to do with it because having to carry the ore up that, because once it was in the elevator, it didn't really matter how far up it was. But what really did matter was the size of the rooms, and so they found it more profitable to come up towards the surface and start knocking out some of the supporting structure up at the top, which was inevitable that it would doom the mine. And they had several plans to build a cofferdam and stuff out into the water to keep it from filling up with the ocean, but nobody ever did anything, really.
So there are lots of mining towns scattered around the United States. Many of them today, like Treadwell, could be considered a ghost town. What made Treadwell special in its time?
It was not a prospecting town. It was a production town. So you drew a regular paycheck, ate at the mess hall, slept in the bunkhouse, had your clothes washed at the laundry. And so it wasn't a speculation where people would ride out on a mule or something out into the hills and try to find something. They were just full-time employees. The mass of gold ore there was just tremendous in size. It was virtually unprecedented at that time.
Is there gold left?
Oh, sure. The whole area here in Juneau is called a highly mineralized zone. This is why we have two major gold mines here now.
I'm surprised when I walk out at Treadwell, and I will join you next week. I'm interested to get the narrative because in the many years I've hiked out there, there's been so little information present on the trail itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I am surprised at how few structures are left. Yeah. What happened to Treadwell?
It burned, and it was no longer used, and they had some buildings down there that were still being used. The foundry was used for many, many years after the Treadwell mine ended. But, it was a company town, and you had really no business being there if you weren't employed. And so it had at least one major fire, and I think another smaller fire too. But so they were wooden structures and dilapidated, so and closely packed.
Are there one or two personalities or figures that stand out in your imagination associated with Treadwell?
Well, of course, John Treadwell was, you know, lent his name to it, and he was certainly in the right place at the right time. French Pete Arisard and Edmund Bean were the discoverers.
A couple of lone prospectors initially up here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one Arisard was from France, and Edmund Bean was from California.
Kaya, the history walks around town, as well as the Treadwell walks, is this relatively new for the Juno Douglas City Museum?
We've been doing the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday walks for several years. This summer is, I believe, the first summer we've kind of branched out to do some of these other themed walks. So we had a geology walk earlier this summer with Kathy Connor and Mike Blackwell, and now the Treadwell walk with Jim Garrity. So, and they've been wildly popular, which we're very pleased about, and hope to be able to continue these next summer.
An emphasis on living history, really.
Yes.
So we are talking with Kaya Henriksen. She is the program director for the Juno Douglas City Museum. And our other guest is Jim Garrity. He will be leading an already sold out walk at Treadwell next Wednesday, July 26th. But a second one has been scheduled for August 24th. And what time do they start? Is it 5:30?
Yes, it's 5:30.
And if someone is interested in doing the August walk, they should sign up. Can they sign up online, or do they need to come to the City Museum in person?
They can either come to the City Museum in person, or they can call us at 586-3572, and we can do the reservation over the phone.
And I think, is it $25? Is that correct?
It's $25, yes.
Well, I encourage folks, if you're at all interested in learning about the living history, right across the channel from us, and take a walk with Jim Garrity in August to sign up now. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for joining a Juno Afternoon.